I'm getting my ski legs back tomorrow.
Ooh, how excited
going to
are you
Milton Keynes. I am excited, although, you know, I mentioned I was doing my running challenge.
31 miles in 31 days.
Yeah. Well, thankfully, I've completed it already.
Ooh.
But I think I overdid it.
Oh.
So I've twinged my knee, Martin, so I'll join you in the pit of injuries.
You want my crutches is what you're saying.
Yeah, please. I feel like I need them. So I'm a bit slightly anxious about my knee tomorrow. But yeah, off to Milton Keynes to the indoor ski slope.
Lovely. I've never been skiing. What put me off is someone at school, she went on a ski thing through school and absolutely decimated her knee. So yeah, it kind of put me off. At Prey, I probably could get on board with the drinks, the hot chocolate. Yeah, but not the actual skiing. Hi, I'm Charlotte Fox-Reese.
I'm Hannah Clark, and welcome to The Ag Show.
In this week's episode, we'll be hearing about how we can learn from how farming is done abroad.
That's right. To kick things off, we're joined by Berkshire farm girl Eleanor Gilbert, who spent the majority of last year harvesting an epic 130,000 acres across the Great Plains of the United States.
We would travel 4 hours in the combine to our next field with the headers, 45-foot headers on, and it would be nothing. If you came to a car, well, you just tilted the header to a side, let the car drive under, and you all carried on.
Not to be outdone, Hattie McFadden, an AHDB-sponsored Nuffield Scholar, visited the likes of the US, Mexico, Ireland, India and Brazil to complete her studies, looking at how dairy farmers around the world are adapting to climate change.
I wanted to look at as many climate adaptation practices as possible. So how do we stop our cows getting so hot? How do we ensure water security? How do we protect ourselves from floods, etc.?
A reminder, new episodes of The Ag Show drop every Wednesday at midday, available wherever you get your podcasts.
With audio and video versions for every show, just subscribe to make sure you don't miss an episode.
And please reach out to us. We'd love to hear from you as always. Please comment on any of our social posts or email agshow@hdb.org.uk. Charlotte, it's cow time. What have you been finding in the news recently that's caught your eye?
Wow. Hannah, Martin, do you know what time of year we're almost at? Because it's almost time for me to get excited about another season event. And all importantly, it's not Christmas. Because, and I hope you are taking notes, Martin, it is nearly Valentine's Day. And that does mean that supermarkets are already limbering up for one of the biggest dine-in showdowns of the year. And the grocer's latest range preview shows retailers are going big on indulgence. And despite price pressures, beef is still keeping its reputation and association with this romantic holiday. So most supermarkets are offering between 2 and 4 beef options within their meal deal ranges. So that's when you get a main, a side or two, some drinks and a dessert for a set price. But what we are seeing is actually Waitrose particularly is going all in and really getting behind beef. So they've got 6 different beef dishes to tempt shoppers at home. But it's not all about steaks and beef pies and Wellingtons, although these are really looking quite dominant between these dine-in menus. Marry me chicken, salmon en croûte and duck legs are also seeming to be popular. Ever heard of marry me chicken before?
I have, but I've no idea what it is. Actually,
it's a creamy, cheesy, tomato-y, chicken-y dish. I mean, it sounds quite nice, but for me, I think Valentine's is all about beef and particularly steaks. But what we do see as well is that these dine-in deals are probably quite likely to be a bit of a battleground. So trying to capture that stay-at-home Valentine's spend. So it's trying to offer those shoppers a restaurant-style experience, but not having that restaurant price tag. And consumers are looking for ways that they can trade up for this occasion. Retailers are really trying to see that, you know, premium protein, so like beef, could be that hero for the night. So whether it's going to be a steak that you choose to celebrate with, Martin, when you are taking Mrs. Martin out for a romantic meal.
Mrs. Martin is having a cheese sandwich this Valentine's Day.
Oh, who said that romance is dead?
She's going to be on a plane at the time.
Oh, okay. So she might not mind it so much then. But supermarkets are sort of betting big on beef to win this Valentine's Day. So hopefully some really welcome news for the industry. Hannah, what have you been up to and what have you been reading?
Well, I wanted to take the opportunity of the news section to flag our Agri Market Outlook that we produce twice a year. But we're working through our sector forecasts at the moment. So our outlooks are all available online and they go into detail on our expectations for the market for the coming year and beyond. So what we think is going to happen with production levels, with trade, with consumer demand. So obviously Valentine's Day plays a key part there for occasions and things like that. We produce an outlook for all the sectors we cover. And we started last week with the dairy outlook. Susie Stannard, our lead analyst for dairy, takes us through the highlights.
Dairy markets have had a rough ride, but we may finally be seeing signs of a floor. In early 2026, we're starting to see wholesale prices for skim milk powder and cheese starting to lift. But fats still under real pressure, because there's still far too much milk in the system. That's why farm gate prices are likely to stay under pressure until at least mid-2026. Slowing down production is vital for recovery. But there is positive news. Retail cheese demand is forecast to grow by 3%, and yogurt is forecast to grow by 7%, driven by health, protein, and affordable indulgence. GB milk production is forecast to stabilise this year, with only marginal growth. That's great, but spring processing capacity will still be tight, keeping a lid on prices until well into 2026. Although things are tough right now, the outlook is bright, British Dairy. Demand for affordable, nutritious, sustainable, delicious dairy is strong, both here and abroad.
That was Susie Stannard, and we'll have more highlights like that in the Ag Show over the coming weeks as we release more of our sector forecasts. We're really pleased to be joined now by Eleanor, or Ellie Gilbert, who you may know as Berkshire Farm Girl on social media. Ellie, welcome to the Ag Show. We're so pleased to have you. Could you start by telling us a bit about what you get up to on farm?
Of course. Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it, and what a great podcast you have. I've just turned 24 and I'm not originally from a farming background, but I've now grown up since the age of about 16 on my stepfather's arable farm just here in Newbury, Berkshire.
And I understand you recently got back from quite a big trip away in the States. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. So I've just been completing something called the 2000 mile harvest. So where we start at the bottom of America at Texas and work all the way up to North Dakota. When I was at university at Harper Adams studying, during my placement year, I wanted to visit the States and do my work experience out there. But unfortunately, due to COVID, we were advised by the university to stay back in the UK. So that all went sideways. And since then, I had been talking to a lot of older farmers who said, the one thing I regretted in life was not doing the 2000 mile harvest in America, because they'd all seen the documentary that the BBC made called The Yellow Trail from Texas, the 2000 mile harvest. And they all wished they did it. And I thought, you know what? I'm just going to go for it. It's probably going to be the toughest thing I've ever done. And it was. But I didn't want to regret not doing it. So I was like, I'm going to go for it after I graduated from university.
Definitely. We've spoken about working abroad before and just the how rewarding that experience is. You know, you get so much out of it and it's scary when you first do it. But it's such a fantastic experience. How long were you out there for, Ellie?
So I flew over in April and I was out there for 8 months. But I lived on the road, so I lived in a camper for 6 months. I was with Paplow's Trucking and Harvesting. They're one of the only crews that take females out there. And I think I'm one of maybe two or three from the UK that's ever done it. So we started in Iowa on the Minnesota border, right in the middle of America. And we headed down to Texas and I traveled through 8 US states. Wow. Spent 6 months on the road. I put over 1,000 hours on a combine. Well, I actually had two because we had put so many hours on the first one, had to swap to another one. I hauled a combine on the back of a truck, just under 4,000 miles. And in total, with our 10 combines, we harvested about 130,000 acres. It was challenging, it was tough, and also some extreme weathers that I would never, ever imagine even existed until I went out there. It's nothing like we get here in the UK.
Yeah. I mean, we've been watching some of your YouTubes, and I think we've got a clip of some of that extreme weather that you experienced.
Look at that storm brewing. Oh my gosh, the lightning just won't stop. Also, I just want to put it out there, it wasn't Izzy that was getting stuck, by the way, in the mud. She's a very good green cart operator. It's starting to spit. Oh, raining, and we're all just running to try and get the field finished before it thunders and lightnings and hails and rains. The lightning's going well in front now. I don't know if you can see it on the video. There it goes.
Jeez.
Oh, it's starting to get stormy. And it's coming, the rain. Oh! Did you see that lightning? Oh my gosh, look at the rain.
Put our window wipers on.
We're just trying to get this field finished. We've not got long left. We've got literally two or three more strips. In between five combines, we could do it. And that's it. We've had to stop. Too much rain. Moisture's getting up. Just not going to work. Got to park up. Look at the lightning. Going for it.
So you said there were five combines. How big was that one field, Ellie?
Oh, I don't know how exactly big that field was, but when we got to Montana, which was absolutely beautiful, we were combining in 1,000-acre fields. And it was pretty impressive when we had 10 of us or even 8 of us in a field. It did get slightly chaotic, though.
I bet that's a lot to manage. You're on the walkie-talkies quite a lot.
Yeah, especially when we first got going in Kiowa. None of us really knew what we were doing, and trying to figure out the GPS was a challenge. And we were combining in a field of terraces, something called terraces. So they're big mounds that they use for drainage out there. We basically can't use GPS. So we literally got on a combine and we were just let loose. We were just crossing each other like this because we were going around. And it was definitely a lot of talking on the CB. But once we got going, by the time we got to Montana, I think we were all a little bit better.
My goodness me. And for context, I think the average farm, the average arable farm size in the UK is what, like 200 acres? And you were in 1,000 acre fields?
Yes. I mean, the scale of it out there was incredible. When I was in Kiowa, Kansas, we would travel 4 hours in the combine to our next field with the headers, 45 foot headers on, and it would be nothing. I mean, it would be mentally tiring for us because there'd be telegraph poles right next to us, but the boss would go and we'd all just be like, right, okay, it's time to follow. And we've got our headers on and the big convoy would go through. And if you came to a car, well, you just tilted the header to a side, let the car drive under and you all carried on. So it was definitely something mind-blowing.
And what was it like being in that sort of size gang and working with others? And did you say you were one of the only girls?
No, so there were 7 females and we all lived in an 8-bed camper. So that was tough. Mm. It was tight. And as you can imagine, we work with these people, we sleep with these people, we eat with these people, we have to go shopping with these people. And we've never met each other before. And often in a big group, it did get quite intense sometimes and you can't get away from it. You have to be very mentally resilient, not only to work the long hours, but also to cope with a big group of you together. Because often there was arguments or jealousy because some people got to drive different things. And it's to be expected when you're living with a crew of 25 to 26 of us. When I went to speak to my boss, he said only 5% of you will make it to the end.
Wow.
And I probably should have taken that as alarm bells at the time, but I thought of it as a challenge. In the end, only 2 of us made it, right from the beginning all the way to the end, out of the original 25 of us that came through. So if that doesn't say it, that it's challenging, then I'm not really sure what does.
That's incredible. And throw in 25 strangers from all over the place, let alone the long hours and the stressful conditions and the fight and the weather and all the rest of it. It's a lot to contend with, isn't it? I'm really interested to know what sort of your typical, I mean, there wouldn't be a typical day, but what were you getting up to and what kind of crops were you harvesting?
So we combine anything from wheat barley, oilseed rape, but they call it canola out there. We also combined chickpeas, which we had to be careful of because they were notorious for catching a light. So we had to make sure we blew off the cage veins, which is just above the concaves of the combine, right inside, to get rid of all the dust. We also combined lentils, which is an interesting crop as well, because they were very, very tiny. They were probably only about this tall. And you had to like literally skim the floor to combine them. Mm. And we also combined peas and beans. So that was just in the main harvest. And then we did the full harvest after, which we combined corn and soybeans. So in terms of the combining, we were changing concaves every few weeks, which was, I thought I was going to die every time I did it. But yeah, it was interesting to see how many different crops we combined throughout the season. A typical work day, I would say we're in Montana, because that was probably our longest stop, which was a month. And you've got to remember that we're in the middle of nowhere. The closest supermarket is probably 2 hours away. We can't just rely on going back to a yard at the end of the day because we're living on the road. So first thing, every single morning, we would take the fuel bowser to the local fuel station and fill it up so we could take it to the field to fill the combines up with fuel. The truck drivers would probably go and dump their load from the night before at the elevators or at their bins. And us combine drivers would start doing the maintenance on the combines, getting them all ready for the day, changing concaves if we need to. We would then probably combine for 15 hours if we could at least. We'd have so many breakdowns. As you saw, we can get stuck in the mud 10 times a day sometimes in certain places. So every day was different. But I definitely do know how to fix a combine now. I went in there not really knowing a lot, but now I could probably figure out most problems with a combine harvester. And then we would pack up at the end of the day, make sure everything's covered up in case the rain comes, because you never know when it's going to come out there, and then sort of do it all over again.
Yeah, from my limited experience with driving combines in New Zealand, I didn't know how many grease nipples were on a combine before having to do that every morning. Is that something you've, your newfound ability in mechanical skill, is that something you've been able to take back home?
Yes, definitely. I think that's one of the biggest things. Resilience and mechanical skills, and also learning how to cope with difficult people, is probably some of the biggest takeaways that I've had. But definitely, after putting 1,200 hours on a combine harvester, I'd hope I'm a little bit better.
So Ellie, knowing what you know now, would you go back and change anything, or would you still go ahead and have taken part in this incredible experience from the sounds of it?
So it's a difficult one. As a farmer, you just love harvesting, and it's definitely a lot of people's favourite time of the year. And I love the work. It was long hours, and sometimes I don't remember driving home because I was so exhausted. I think I worked 4 months without a day off or even an hour off from 7 a.m. past midnight every night. Yes, I would do it again, but I think I would choose a different crew to go on. Now I've seen all the crews and the different companies out there. There's definitely a few different ones that have caught my eye.
I think on that note, it's time for a quick break, but we'll catch up with Ellie a little bit later in the show.
Hi, I'm Alice Perry with the latest from AHDB for the week commencing the 25th of May. Our chair, Emily Norton, has responded to the latest Farm Assurance Review Progress Report, highlighting work on 14 key recommendations and continued efforts alongside industry partners to support changes within the Farm Assurance schemes. We've also published a joint paper with the NFU outlining the purpose, scope and value of Farm Assurance. New opportunities for UK agri-food exports will follow the UK's trade deal with the Gulf Cooperation Council. Tariffs are to be removed on products including dairy, cereals and lamb, helping improve competitiveness in a region where demand for high-quality imports continues to grow. And farmers have the chance to get ahead on environmental planning with our new series of baselining roadshows. The countrywide events happening in June will provide practical guidance on measuring and understanding farm data. That's all for now. Find out more at ahdb.org.uk.
Welcome to AHDB's Forage for Knowledge update for Thursday, the 21st of May.
This week's average growth at 63 kilos of dry matter per hectare is lower than the same period in previous years. With slurry and fertiliser applications going on, it's worthwhile thinking about what else could be limiting grass growth. Are your soils working at their optimum, be that biologically, structurally, or chemically? Liming and correcting suboptimal pH opens the possibilities of increasing availability of NPK and S from biological or chemical sources. Also, to capture the full potential of clover to reduce bagged nitrogen, pH needs to be 6.5. Check and lime if necessary. On grass quality, the averages this week have been 20.3% dry matter, 12.3 ME, 20.9 protein. I'm Emily Udall. For more analysis and commentary from Piers Badnall, go to the AHDB website and search Forage for Knowledge.
Now, continuing on the theme of working abroad, Charlotte and I recently caught up with Hattie McFadgen, an HDB-sponsored Nuffield scholar. She's very well-travelled, and she's ticked off the likes of the US, Mexico, Ireland, India, and Brazil as part of her studies.
But before jumping into all the details, Hattie began by telling us what a Nuffield scholarship actually is.
So Nuffield scholarship, it is a trust that ensures that passionate people from agriculture can essentially go abroad and learn from other people and then bring that knowledge back to the UK. So it's an organisation that finds really passionate people who have that topic that they're really interested in, and they really want to spend 2 weeks digging into it, traveling abroad, going, finding out all that useful information, and then bring it back and implement it in your own business and also throughout the sector. So it's a really good opportunity.
Is that overseas travel that really important part of it then? Is that, you know, something that has to be done?
Yeah, so for the vast majority, I think everybody wants to go overseas, and the guy that set it up, he, William Morris, had his kind of Morris Minor car factory. He went over to see Henry Ford, learned a bunch of really cool stuff, and came back to the UK and actually revolutionised his car production business. So he very much had the thought process, how do I get other people doing this in the agricultural sector? So it's expected that you go abroad for about 8 weeks on average. Some people do like 3, 4, 5 months. Some people do a minimum of about 6 to 8 weeks. Going to a few countries to see what you can learn. So good opportunity for travel as well.
I didn't realise Nuffield had its origins in the car sector.
Correct.
I did not know that.
So he set up Nuffield on the agriculture side and also Nuffield Health.
Hattie, how did you get into your Nuffield scholarship? What made you go for it?
I actually never thought that I would do one. Probably because I thought it was just for farmers and I wasn't, you know, I worked in the agriculture sector. My granddads were farmers, but I wasn't living, breathing on the farm.
Yeah.
It was because I was chewing the ear off of a colleague so much about climate resilience that he was kind of a bit fed up and said, Hattie, would you just please go to a Nuffield? Like, it would give you an opportunity to spend 2 years really digging into this topic so that you don't have to natter at me essentially all the time about it. He'd done one as well. So he put the idea in my head and said, you know, you don't have to be a farmer. Yes, the vast majority are farmers, which is fantastic, but other people can do it too if you're linked to the agricultural sector. So I thought, yeah, let's give it a go. So I applied and, yeah, grateful that I got the opportunity.
For your abroad parts, where did you end up going and how long for?
I did travel for 8 weeks in total. When you get given your award, you get given it in about November. And then in February, all global Nuffielders meet together. So a host country has the conference. And thankfully, in my year, the conference was held in Brazil.
Oh, amazing.
Whereas the year before, it was held in Norfolk. So I was really lucky to kind of go be on the Brazil.
Norfolk.
I was very lucky to be on the Brazil cohort. This year's is in Japan. Next year's is in Zimbabwe. So I started with Brazil, which was great. Spent about a week there. And then I came back, I kind of assessed my options and I ended up going to the US, Mexico, India and Ireland because I wanted to see different climates. I wanted to see different stages of dairying. So some had quite innovative emerging markets like India, and the US obviously has got their kind of massive, quite infrastructure heavy dairy parlours, etc. So it was a mixture of climates and dairy markets, which was good. I think the climate was really tricky. There's a day of 50 degrees heat in northern Mexico.
Wow.
Which, never mind the cows, I was really suffering from heat stress that day. My background's in climate science. I did a master's in climate science development and policy, and there was so much talk about what's going to happen to our weather systems. And coming from an agricultural family, I was a little bit shocked that nobody was talking about our food production. How are we going to actually produce food under these more extreme climate conditions? After uni, I went and I worked with farmers in Burma, actually, for 3 years, who are experiencing really rapid climate change.
Mm.
And then at the start of the pandemic, I came back to the UK, focused on getting my agricultural career in the UK now. And it was kind of like, nobody's talking about it over here. Like, we are going to experience climate change, but we're talking about sustainability and efficiency, but actually it's going to get a little bit harder and a little bit easier in some cases too, due to our changing weather. So I was trying to find space in the industry at Promar to see what can we do about climate resilience. And this is why I really wanted to go to Nuffield to really develop that idea. And now it's so much clearer 2 years on what we need to do as a sector and what we can do, what the opportunities are.
So you just said about obviously developing that idea. I think I'm one of those that I'd come up with an idea, but actually the more I start looking into it, the more that idea evolves and then perhaps changes. Is that something that you're able to do?
Yeah, so I think when I first set out on the Nuffield, I wanted to look at as many climate adaptation practices as possible. So how do we stop our cows getting so hot? How do we ensure water security? How do we protect ourselves from floods, etc.? And I spoke to a lot of farmers who were doing a lot of things, and it very rapidly occurred to me that it became less about what should we do? Because actually the number of adaptation practices that we have are infinite. There are loads, and I very quickly learned this. Then the kind of topic became, how do we do that? So how do we actually inspire people to start integrating adaptation practices into our farm management now? Because it's quite a scary topic, actually, if we talk about weather systems changing. And actually, we need to approach it in a way that takes the fear out of the topic completely and also motivates people to look into it by looking at the financials of it too. Like, how much is weather variability going to cost us in the future as a farming sector in 20, 30, 40 years in comparison to now? So it's interesting you say about the kind of ideas developing. It gives you that 2 year period to almost think of nothing else. And it allows you the flexibility and freedom for that, like, ideas to undulate and develop over time.
So it's not too rigid, is what you're saying. You kind of have to have your basis. That's what you've obviously been given that money for, but see where it takes you.
You have to have that topic. And AHDB sponsored me because you guys are very interested in climate resilience of that topic. How then I travelled, who I spoke to, and the kind of conclusions that came out of that and how I presented those conclusions are all things that you pick up along the way and you start to build a really good idea around.
The bit when I was sort of reading into what you have to do as a Nuffield scholar that made me feel a little bit like, oh, a 40-page report and a presentation? How was it having to put 2 years into just 40 pages in 12 minutes?
You know what? The word limit's actually gone down to 5,000 words. Okay. So it used to be 10,000. And then they thought, a few people are going to read all those 10,000 words, but really we need to get better at disseminating that information. So it cut down to a 5,000-page report, which I definitely went over, and then a 12-minute presentation. And you're right, the 12-minute presentation is quite daunting. It's quite structured. So it's essentially like, what's the problem? What did I do for 2 years? And then what are your conclusions? Let's hit the ground running. And actually, there's a bit of beauty in having a presentation that short, because it engages people and it kind of teases people the answers. And then people come up to you and say, right, I'm interested. What are we doing? What are we doing about this issue? So it was very daunting to have a 12-minute presentation after 2 years of research, but it forces you to really pick out your key messages and the impact of that.
suppose the beauty with it as well, though, is you've got that huge document behind it as well that, yeah, you can just be giving those sort of top key findings, can't you? Because actually everything else is going to be in that written report too.
Yeah, exactly. And I know that Nuffield are doing a series of initiatives that actually you have those big reports, but actually you now have a shorter, almost like executive summary that's more like infographics based for people that learn in a different way as well. Mm-hmm. So now you have a verbal presentation, you have a short kind of visual summary, and then you have a longer report based on your learning type, essentially. So they're definitely trying to disseminate that information more and more.
Have you got any top tips for anyone that's listening and thinking, oh, Nuffield Scholarship, that sounds like something interesting or something I might be considering doing?
Yeah, definitely. Top tips, display your passion. I think Nuffield is about passionate people doing really cool things. So display that passion. Make sure you love your topic, because if you don't, it will get dull after 2 years. There's not many Nuffield scholars that say, I don't know about my topic anymore. That's because we have to demonstrate we really love it and we're ready to spend all that time developing into it. And chuck yourself into the application, see what it asks, and then you'll get to the next stage, see what that stage looks like. If you fall down, try again the next year, because it's a really rewarding journey, if I'm honest. So I want people, farmers, to apply, but also people just in the agricultural industry in general, whether that's even in communications in agriculture or whatever. If it's linked to agriculture, you can apply and Nuffield's for you.
We'll hear more from Hattie next week, where she'll explain what she found out on her studies, which were given the full title of Enhancing the Resilience of the UK Dairy Sector. How do we practically adapt to increasingly volatile weather conditions? Anyone interested in applying for a scholarship themselves should go to nuffieldscholar.org. The closing date for applications is 31st of July. Right, we'll be back in conversation with Berkshire Farm Girl Eleanor in a mo.
Hi, I'm Annabelle Twinbarrow, analyst at the AHDB, here with a look at the domestic dairy market for the week commencing 25th of May. GB milk volumes have now slipped into marginal year-on-year decline, and we are now past the seasonal spring peak. March deliveries were 0.1% lower year-on-year, and May-to-date volumes are down by 0.4%, though this is against a record high. In the latest UK wholesale price survey for May, prices remained under pressure, impacted by ample supplies of fat. The average price for mild cheddar was £2,940 a tonne, 1% lower than the last period. Bulk cream prices remain at half the value of a year ago. Minimal movement in the average month pricing gave an average for the month of £1,220 a tonne. The butter price moved down £200 a tonne, 6%, to £3,330 a tonne. However, S&P average prices did see another month of strength, ending at an average of £2,500 a tonne, a month-on-month increase of £140 a tonne. This is the only commodity that is more valuable than a year ago, as demand for protein remains strong. For the latest data and analysis on red meat, dairy and arable markets, head to ahdb.org.uk and click on Markets and Prices.
So we're back chatting with Ellie, the Berkshire Farm Girl. Ellie, you've been back for a little while now. What have you been up to since coming back from the States?
A charity Christmas tractor run. I've been organising it whilst I was out in the US, but I arrived home. Jet lag was a little bit difficult, but we raised over £14,000 for Newbury Cancer Care, a charity that was close to the whole community here and also to my family too, because my mum was poorly when me and my sister were younger. So it was my way of giving back to them. And I've also been just catching up on everything that's been happening on my pumpkin patch, which I run, and Maize. Whilst I was away, I was doing it again whilst I was in America and had some amazing people at home to run it for me this year. And then I'm hoping to run it again now I'm home. So catching up on all of that stuff. And I've also in the last few days been slurry tanking and hedge cutting on the farm here.
Keeping very busy then is what it sounds like. It doesn't sound like you've had any break.
A few days over Christmas, maybe.
And you're quite the local celebrity, both locally and online. So is that part of something that you end up wanting to be doing when you're out and about, really being that ambassador for farming and for young farmers?
Yes, definitely. I mean, it was all started up originally to bridge that knowledge gap between the general public and farmers, to show people where their food comes from, that it's not just from the supermarket. And also to encourage young people to get into farming, because it's such a great environment to be in and so many skills can be learned within this sector. One of the reasons I documented it online whilst I was in America is to show people that maybe they thought, if I can do it, then they can do it too. And I think I was one of the first people to document it out in America. So it's definitely something I'd like to carry on with. It is almost like a full-time job, though, editing them videos, because I did do one every Friday, Saturday and Sunday, and sometimes on Monday whilst I was out in America. And I look back on it and I think, oh gosh, some of the editing's a bit rubbish, or I wish I did better there. But I say to myself, look, I was working 100-hour weeks and I was often editing at midnight or 5 o'clock in the morning. So yeah, I definitely something I'd like to carry on doing. And if anyone that's listening to the podcast is thinking about doing an American harvest, I'd be more than happy for you to contact me under Barch Farm Girl on any of my socials to have a chat about it.
I was just going to ask, Ellie, you started your YouTubing when you were out in the States. Were you doing anything before then? Because you've got quite the following now, haven't you?
So I started it about 7 years ago, but I've always been in education, so university or school or college. So I've never really been able to go for it because I've only ever been able to film it during certain seasons that I'm working on the farm. And the YouTube is really difficult because you have to have so many subscribers and so many watch hours and you have to keep it going every year. So I managed to keep it going for about 3 years. That was one of my most recent things, my YouTube. But if you stop, then they like cut you off. And then whilst I was in America, obviously it was a long period, so it started to build up again there. But yeah, it's I've been doing it for quite a few years now, but I'm sort of just taught myself about how to do it. I don't really still know what I'm doing, but I'll just give it a go.
And did you find your following kind of took off when you were putting content out from the States? Because that's really unique stuff to watch, isn't it, for viewers back home?
Yes, I think so. When I was out in the States, everyone loved the big trucks and the scale and just the story of each week of what's going on. So I had a lot of opportunities from my social media before, which I would never have had at such a young age. But definitely now I'm back from the States, the following's gone up.
So Ellie, you've done so much over the past year. What's next? What have you got planned for 2026?
Oh, well, I'm hoping to have a look potentially at joining an Australian harvest. I thought, you know what? I've done the American harvest. A few months in Australia would be great. I'd also carry on with my YouTube and social media and hopefully building my pumpkin patch and maize here in Newbury, Berkshire, a bit more whilst I'm home and have a little bit of time.
Just more harvest. We love it. We've been all over the world this episode, haven't we, Charlotte? I'm
no
tired.
No stamps, my passport.
No, a massive thank you to Ellie and Hattie for telling us about their experience abroad, doing Nuffield, doing 2,000 mile harvests. Incredible, incredible stories.
And I think that's probably all we've got time for this week. So do reach out on any of our socials or on our email, so agshow@ahdb.org.uk, if you have any questions, if you've got anything you think would be interesting for us to feature, or if you want to leave us a review. We do love to hear from you, so do reach out. And we will see you when our next episode drops, Wednesdays midday.